Our next case this morning is case number 53100, Clarence Stewart v. State of Nevada. For the appellant, we have Mr. E. Brent Bryson, and for the respondent, State of Nevada, we have the District Attorney, David J. Roger. I'm just waiting for everybody to settle down before we... And I think everybody has finished their movement, so Mr. Bryson, on behalf of Mr. Stewart, would you like to reserve some time also?
I would, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes also.
Okay.
And I would also request that all the issues, any issues we don't specifically address today that were fully briefed by the parties, that those be submitted upon the briefs and that they not be deemed waived simply because they're not discussed here today.
Certainly, we realize that.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Never has there been, nor will there likely be again, an individual, when his name is spoken, who invokes such a diverse passion from the American public as Orenthal James Simpson. Clarence Stewart should have never been tried with O.J. Simpson. In a poll taken in 2001, it was found that 72%, Justice Saeda, 72%, Justice Cherry, 72%, and Justice Gibbons, 72% of the American public believed that O.J. Simpson was wrongfully acquitted of the double murder in California. In this case, Clarence Stewart was wrongfully convicted. Prior to the trial, we came before this court on several occasions and tried to get the matter settled. This court put the trust in the trial court and even issued an opinion, the Chartier case, right before the day, I believe the day before this case started. But there was a specific mandate from this court to the trial court saying, we have faith in you, trial court, and you are reminded that at every stage of this proceeding, of this trial, if prejudice is manifested, that you should sever. And what did the trial court do before the trial even started, even after the admonishment by this court? The trial court stated in open court, severance is dead. In clear violation of this court's mandate and well-established Nevada and United States constitutional law. Your trust in the trial court to do the right thing was misplaced. The trial court didn't do the right thing. And the state from the very beginning infused the baggage that O.J. Simpson brought to this trial into the trial of Mr. Stewart. Sitting on the back of Mr. Stewart, as I sat next to Mr. Stewart, was a big monkey, a big ape, the baggage of O.J. Simpson.
Well, Mr. Bryson, if I could ask you this, and I understand your points, and there's several issues with this severance that I think Justice Cherry's going to go into, but wouldn't the jury, to hear the complete story of why Mr. Stewart was there at this incident, have to hear about the Goldman trial, the civil judgment, the turnover order in California on these personal property, and the fact that Mr. Simpson allegedly tried to conceal it through these other witnesses, and so wasn't it going to come out, his involvement with Mr. Simpson?
You know, to what degree it would have come out, I'm sure it would have come out in certain aspects, but certainly not in the ways that it did here that were so prejudicial.
Well, I'm concerned about it coming out in the initial, the jury questionnaire and the initial voir dire, if you could comment on that. I mean,
Stewart's just Stewart.
He isn't O.J. Simpson. There's no doubt they're two different type of people. But
that's correct, but how about in the opening statement? Not only in addition to questions about the voir dire, can you set this aside, ladies and gentlemen, but then simply having the prospective jurors say yes, not being allowed to dig further and to determine, well, why are you able to set
If Stewart had been tried separately, there wouldn't have been any talk about the California cases and picking the jury. They wouldn't have to determine whether Simpson was guilty or innocent in California.
100% accurate. Nor would they have heard an opening statement from the state that they were going to show the true face of Orenthal Jane Simpson. They wouldn't have known about that.
But is it a bit disingenuous that while, given severance, Mr. Simpson may not have been sitting next to your client, and perhaps opening statements would have been very different because obviously Mr. Galanter and Mr. Grasso wouldn't have been there. But nonetheless, the entire story of this crime would have required an awful lot of mention, reference to the very person that you say 72% of the public has a visceral reaction to. So he's there, whether he's there physically or not.
And again, to a certain extent, that's true. But statements such as, we're going to have you write the last chapter. The final story is going to be told to you. We're going to expose the true face, the hidden face of Mr. Simpson.
Those statements of Mr. Simpson,
all told in the beginning of this opening statement, would have no place in a separate trial of Mr. Stewart. It's completely irrelevant. Don't forget, we were here because supposedly there was a robber. Well, the real robbery here is Mr. Stewart was robbed of a fair and impartial trial. That's the robbery.
When these statements were made, did you object at the time?
Absolutely.
Did you move for severance again?
Time and time again, over 40-some times during the course of this trial, I moved for severance. Let me give you some instances of specific prejudice where I asked for this trial to be severed and to move on. When they injected Mr. Simpson's background into the trial, all through the trial, the California murder cases, they speak about the Goldmans. They imply that Mr. Simpson is deceitful and puts on a false face. That doesn't come in, Justice Saida, to a separate trial of Mr. Stewart. Where Judge Glass recognizes that because of the notoriety and infamy of Mr. Simpson, he should be given an extra preemptory challenge simply for that reason. We object and we say, severance, because if we have our own trial, we get all of the preemptory challenges as they pertain. But even she recognized.
How did you work the preemptory challenges? Individually, how did you do it?
Well, we had to agree upon them, at least on the face. That's what the statute
says. So you had nine altogether, and then you and Mr. Glanter would work them out on who you'd preempt?
Well, yes, we had to work them out, and then we had, I believe there were four as to the alternative, so the exact number escapes me at this point. But regardless, right. We were on the cameras and in the courtroom. It looked like we were very much in agreement as to the challenges. But if you were behind the scenes and in the back room where there's no cameras and no recorders, we argued about these all the time. Yet we were forced to put them together in the trial.
That happens anytime you have co-defendants.
Well, it certainly does. But there is no co-defendant, I will tell you, there is no co-defendant like O.J. Simpson. There never will be again. There's no baggage that's ever been like that.
So there may be some personal baggage, but the law requires, and you referenced the case, it's the Chartier case, the law requires that there be antagonistic defenses that require a showing of, and I quote, conflicting and irreconcilable defenses.
That's one way, with all due respect. The first way is the spillover that I've been discussing now.
Undoubtedly.
The second way is antagonistic defenses. Let's talk about the antagonistic defenses.
Okay.
O.J. Simpson wanted all of the recordings in. That was his trial strategy. He had a legal trial strategy that he wanted the recordings in. We had a factual trial strategy, and we wanted the recordings out. As a matter of fact, in cross-examination of the state's experts, it was demonstrated that these recordings were inherently untrustworthy. Nobody authenticated these recordings. As a matter of fact, what was demonstrated was that the recordings had been altered, even by the testimony of Mr. Riccio, the individual that made them. A couple files have been deleted. The highfalutin experts the state brought in from Quantico, Virginia, they come in and they say, sorry, we can't tell you that these are true and accurate, and that because they're capable also of having data uploaded, which means words and things to be uploaded, worthless. So we did not want those recordings in. They did. That's a prime trial strategy of antagonistic defenses. They stipulated to let these recordings in. We want them in. There were things on those recordings that may have been admissible against Mr. Simpson, but had absolutely nothing to do with Mr. Stewart.
Well, didn't Mr. Stewart, wasn't his voice heard on the recordings?
His voice, first of all, Mr. Stewart's voice was never heard by that jury at all. Live. There was a recording where Detective Caldwell said, "This is Mr. Stewart's voice." And that would have been the same Detective Caldwell that we had just demonstrated had made multiple errors regarding the tape and the transcription of the tape and what was said on the tape. And it flowing through this, I mean, everything really flows through the idea of we need to get him this time. Even to the extent that the investigating detectives were recorded on the Riccio recording, where they say specifically, California couldn't effing get him. We're going to get him here in Nevada. That was the theme. This whole trial was a makeup call for OJ's California trial, and Mr. Stewart got caught up in it. He was joined at the hip. No matter how many times we kicked and screamed for severance, no matter how many times they talk about, the CSAs in California, we don't want our CSAs to be like the CSAs in California. No matter how many times it talks about how the majority of the jury pool, when they're filling out these questionnaires or when they were questioned a little bit, they were loathed O.J. Simpson. All through this proceeding, we tried to get cut loose to have a fair trial, and she wouldn't cut us loose. She was in a hurry to get this trial done, her being the trial judge.
Did you object to a jury questionnaire, by the way?
No, we wanted a jury questionnaire because we felt the jury questionnaire would be useful. The problem that we objected to, and we made objection over objection, was that we need to be able to ask further questions. I mean, in a case of this magnitude, and when you look at it and you say a case of this magnitude, there was so much press over this case that there had to be an extra media room in this courthouse. So much press over this and to do over this case that probably, if not the most powerful man, certainly one of them in Clark County, personally tried the case. The district attorney. If this was just Mr. Stewart, do you really believe that Dave Roger would have tried this case with a chief deputy attorney?
Well, Mr. Bright, that's Mr. Rogers, the elected official. He can run his office the way he wants.
You bet he could, but I'm just saying, it's the theme, Your Honor.
Can I shift gears with you?
Sure.
If I can, you've raised the Batson issue as well.
Right.
And you heard Mr. Glanter's argument, Mr. Rogers' argument previously. Do you have anything else to add on that issue?
Well, I think that it's interesting that out of all the jurors that were black, and there were two that potentially could have made it up on this jury, that for, quote, religious reasons or apparent reasons that family members had interactions with law enforcement, you know, the questions that the last five jurors, I believe, that made it on to the jurors, or actually to sit on the jury, all said they went to church, and that's great. They all said that they had family members that at one time or another had had interactions with law enforcement. So what's the major difference? The skin color. That's it. That's the only major difference that I could see.
Why do you believe the reasons given by Mr. Roger as for being race neutral are not correct? Or why would you take issue with that?
Well, actually, I'm not saying that they're not correct. I'm saying that they could be applied to all the other juries, the jurors, the last five that were on also. There's no difference. It was an opportunity that they were able to seize upon, And Judge Glass bought upon, with all the rest of the judicial misconduct that she engaged in, to show favoritism towards the state. And yet she absolutely treated us different in front of the jury through the whole trial in answer to some previous questions. There's no doubt about it. The tape reveals it. Our briefs reveal it. We point out specific instances. You can't treat one side as a professional and another side as a child and expect a jury that's watching to understand that these guys are just in the trenches trying to do their job from keeping their clients placed in a cage.
Mr. Bryson, you suggest that other jurors similarly situated to 209 and 177 were not dismissed. Are you making a blanket statement that there was never any other individual in that jury pool who had contact with the police, some dissatisfaction with the prosecutor's office, and that they were summarily allowed to stay? Is that what I hear you saying?
You know, I don't know if I would go as far as saying that there was never another juror that wasn't dismissed. What I'm saying is five of the last six jurors that made it on all had religious ties, had religious beliefs, and family members had interactions with the police. That's what I'm saying. So I don't know how you differentiate.
Well, because there were several hundred that came before that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And unfortunately, it was amazing to me, and we all sat aghast that out of the several hundred that came before, there was only two African Americans that were there in the first place. Somehow they managed to get rid of them.
Any other questions? Just say to Jessica,
no.
I'm going to give you your 3 minutes in rebuttal, and I'm going to give Mr. Roger 18 minutes. I'll add the 3 minutes to his 15. You have 18 minutes, Mr. Roger.
Thank you.
And I'll give you three, Mr. Bryson, in rebuttal.
And Mr. Roger, as I did with Mr. Galanter, in an effort to save you time, because when I'm talking, the clock's not ticking, the severance issue is obviously of significance to us in this matter. I would first like you to address the U.S. versus Fernandez case, which speaks that we need to consider that the failure to sever was significant when, in fact, a jury might fail to apprise the individual evidence against each individual separately. And number two, I would like you to address the comment that Mr. Galanter made in his rebuttal, where he said, quote, Mr. Simpson brought baggage to this trial. How does that affect Mr. Stewart?
Thank you. David Roger, representing the state of Nevada as well as the respondent. Obviously, severance is a big issue for Mr. Stewart. These individuals committed the crimes together. We charged them with conspiracy. They're both actively involved in this case, and I'll get to your comments, Justice Seda. Severance was denied because there were no antagonistic defenses. The defense of Mr. Simpson was that he did not commit any crimes, that he had a claim of right, that this was his property, and he was entitled to go back and get his property. Mr. Stewart's defense was that you couldn't trust, quote, the messenger, unquote. He went through each and every one of these witnesses, and he said they are not credible. I think that, generally speaking, his defense was probably mere presence, although I think he articulated it that you couldn't trust these jurors. Those are not antagonistic defenses that mandates severance. The issue with respect to Mr. Simpson coming in with baggage, I recognize that Mr. Simpson is a high-profile individual, but we also have murder cases where people are, killers are aided or abetted by other individuals, yet we try them together, even though one individual actually did the killing and the other was an aider and abetter. We have the Lyle case that talks about guilt by association as not being a grounds for severance. Kevin Lyle came in with many tattoos. He was a despicable individual. His co-defendant was as well. But the argument that they made was that, hey, I'd have had a better chance if I wasn't sitting right next to Kevin Lyle. And that's just not the law. And you rejected that argument. And so the fact that Mr. Simpson might be notorious or might have a big personality should not be grounds for a severance. And Judge Glass felt that way. I'd urge you to reject the argument that there is a specific O.J. Simpson severance exception to the joinder rule, that just because he had a past that really wasn't the focus of this case, that Mr. Stewart should receive a separate trial. Fact of the matter was that they were pretty close together in their case. There was no argument that Mr. Simpson was the bad guy, that he has the baggage, and that, you know, I was just the good guy coming, standing alone. And I'm going to make an argument, Justice Cherry, and you'll probably disagree, and I've never been a defense lawyer. But it would seem to me that some trial lawyers might very well find that it is advantageous to have a real bad criminal sitting next to them when they are arguing mere presence, and that they could kind of sit back in the background, say very little, and then in closing argument say, hey, I was there, I was a victim as well. It was O.J. Simpson who wanted to bring guns and do this. When you look at, I'm sorry, Justice Ada, you mentioned the Fernandez case, and I was a little distracted.
The import of Fernandez is quite simply whether or not the juror can distinguish between the two individual defendants, and I'm asking you to respond to that question, whether or not you feel in this case the evidence was properly presented that would allow the jurors to view the two individual defendants.
Yes, ma'am. This was a very conscientious jury. They deliberated 13 hours. This wasn't as if they just walked right back in the back jury room and signed the jury verdict. But I think it's also important to take a look at the evidence in this case with respect to Mr. Stewart. Mr. Stewart is the person who was at the Palms Casino at the pool prior to this robbery, talking about the plan to commit this robbery. He was overheard on the audio tape saying, "You ain't playing my gun. There ain't going to be no conversation with them." Mr. Stewart was the one who volunteered to use his truck. Mr. Stewart was on the tape talking about how he didn't want to have to lug the property through the casino. And there was some debate during this trial about whether that was Mr. Stewart at the hotel. And, you know, I'm a prosecutor. We don't cross-examine witnesses an awful lot, and you know, our skills aren't up to what defense attorneys are. And I say this very humbly. Mr. Scotto, who was their alibi witness, who was a witness who was going to say, hey, we were out there shopping for a wedding cake for Mrs. Scotto, and I wasn't there during these conversations. He was destroyed on cross-examination, and he was destroyed because when they talked to Mr. Scotto, they didn't talk to him about some cell phone records. And during the time that he says that Mr. Stewart was not at the Palms Hotel, but instead was driving them around to order the cake, he was on the telephone with Mr. Stewart. And I asked him, I said, you're right in that car. Why would you place a telephone call? And it went downhill from there. And they had another witness that they were going to call, Arnell Simpson, who was out there. They folded their tent. They didn't even call her as a witness. And so the evidence, according to Mr. Ehrlich and Mr. Riccio to a certain extent, as well as Detective Caldwell, who listened to these tapes, who had personally spoken with each of the defendants, was that it was Mr. Stewart at the Palms talking about this. Mr. Stewart was the one who recruited Mr. Alexander, who called him and said, Walter, O.J. Simpson wants to see you over at the hotel. He wants to talk to you about something. Stewart was the one who recruited Cashmore to help carry the property. Stewart was the one who huddled with the other individuals at the Palace Station Hotel lobby. That's on videotape. Mere presence? I don't think so. Stewart was the first one in the hotel room, and he was the one who pushed Fromong up against a chair. Stewart was the one who frisked individuals for weapons. Stewart was the one who commanded the victims to sit by saying, bag it up, bag it up. Stewart was the one who said, you don't know who the F we are. Stewart was the one who carried the property out. Stewart was the one who kept the stolen property in his possession. Stewart was the one who attempted to retain an attorney for Mr. McClinton. And during that meeting with the attorney and Mr. McClinton, he says, remember, there were no guns. So this wasn't mere presence. He was actively involved in this conspiracy. He chose to commit this robbery with Mr. Simpson, and he's properly tried.
Mr. Roger, on the antagonistic defense issue, which is one of the issues we have here relating to the severance, Mr. Bryson says that Mr. Simpson wanted this audio tape admitted and his client didn't. Sounds like an antagonistic defense. What's your thoughts on that?
I would ask you to reject the notion that you should expand the definition of antagonistic defenses to trial strategies. Because one person objects to a piece of evidence and the other doesn't necessarily mean that there are antagonistic defenses. I think it should be exactly what the law says today, that it is a defense and not trial strategies. Otherwise, every defendant could make objections and not make objections and create an issue of antagonistic defenses. His objection to the tapes was not well taken. These tapes, there were two different tapes, one by Mr. Riccio, which included the conversations at the Palms, the conversations up in the hotel room, Mr. Simpson's hotel room at the Palms, the actual robbery were done by a digital tape recorder. Mr. Riccio came in and said that I had this tape recorder on. There's no real question about what was on the tape. And according to Nevada statute, authentication can be done by voice recognition, and we had that testimony. There was no significant issue about the contents.
So the tape would be admissible. Mr. Stewart's voice on it is an admission of a party, and so that's one of the bases for admitting it as to him.
Sure. And you know, if you look at just the pure Crawford analysis, it's non-testimonial. Mr. Bryson talks about juror misconduct and talks about the jury foreman. The jury foreman filled out his questionnaire just like everybody else. He was asked about the criminal trial in California, whether he agreed with the verdict. He said yes. He wrote he was tried and acquitted. It is a separate issue. When he was asked about the civil case, he said the same thing. He agreed with the civil case. His response was he was given a fair trial, which resulted in an outcome. When I asked him questions about those answers, he explained I think my opinion was there is a trial, there is a verdict, and it can't be retried. That this is an individual who is saying that he believes in the jury system. 12 people were asked to sit on that jury, make a decision. They made it, and we have to accept the result. He may have a different opinion deep down about an individual, but he was candid with the court in that jury questionnaire. There was some discussion about cross-examination of Mr. Alexander. Well, let me say it one other thing, and I heard this in both our arguments regarding judicial misconduct, and they said Judge Glass was in a hurry to try this case. I disagree with that assertion. This was a robbery case. I think we probably had maybe 20 witnesses. This took 4 weeks to try. She was in no hurry to try this case. She wasn't trying to shut this down. And when you look at the videotapes, the direct examination is factor X. Cross-examination was factor X plus 5. She gave these defense attorneys a great deal of latitude in developing their case and cross-examining them. And so they weren't given an unfair trial. They were given a fair trial by this judge and this jury. Justice Cherry, with that, unless you have other questions.
Why do about the tenor of the voir dire? If there had been a severance and Stewart had been tried, I mean, we might as well Would you, as DA, decided to try Stewart? I'm just curious.
I try a lot of cases.
Yeah.
I was a prosecutor and a trial lawyer before I became elected district attorney. I've tried cases since I've been elected. I try to try one or two cases a year. This was an important case, I think, to the community, and that's kind of the basis for when I tried cases. I would have tried co-defendants as well.
What about the tenor of the voir dire, though? In other words, there's a lot of talk about the California cases, about the Goldman family, about the order that he needs, that Simpson needs to turn over his assets, that type of stuff. I can't imagine that would have been maybe mentioned, but it would have been dwelled upon with Stewart by himself.
No, sir. I'm not a proponent of jury questionnaires because I think that prolongs and it gives more questions to be asked during voir dire. There wasn't a lot of talk about turnover orders and everything. The question was, did you know about these Californias? Did you disagree or agree? And can you set it aside? And really, that's the focus of voir dire as it should be.
But would that have been necessary if Stewart had been tried by himself to go into the Simpson what difference does it make about the California cases with Simpson with Stewart's being tried? I'm trying to make that connection as to how important it would be. As a prosecutor, would you have asked questions to the jury if there had not been a questionnaire about the California verdicts? I mean, what's the relevance of the California verdicts to Stewart?
It's the totality of the case. All throughout these audio tapes, they're talking about the turnover order. They're talking about the nature of this. They're talking about how these victims allegedly did them wrong. And so that was throughout. That permeated the audio tapes, the entire nature of the case. I didn't ask for this jury questionnaire. They did. I objected to a jury questionnaire. They did. They agreed. They didn't object to the jury questionnaire. And so, you know, they have to live with those results.
What about the argument that Mr. Bryson makes, and Mr. Glanter also, about that the judge did not give them a chance to follow up on the answers to the jury questionnaire? How do you feel about that?
She gave them a great deal of latitude. She allowed them to ask 116 questions of these jurors. In the jury questionnaire, in response to each of those cases, what are your thoughts, feelings, or opinions, if any, about the criminal case? The same thing about the civil case. They were given that opportunity in the jury questionnaire to ask those questions. But what Mr. and it's not fair to Mr. Galanter, but this is the entire record. What they wanted to do was relitigate those California cases and beat down the jurors and show them that the jurors, if there's any question about these other cases, that they didn't know as much as Mr. Galanter or someone else. And they wanted to relitigate those cases, and that was not what this case was about. And I think that it was properly limited to, do you know anything about these cases? You answered the jury questionnaire. Can you set it aside? And let's move on. And those people who had any reservations were summarily dismissed by Judge Glass the previous day without even coming to the courtroom.
Well, I'll give you that you could talk about if Stewart's tried by himself, you certainly could talk about the civil case, and you could ask them whether they agreed or disagreed with the civil case. Well, why the criminal cases of Stewart? Why the murder cases of his ex-wife and Mr. Goldman?
I think that when you're trying co-defendant cases, multiple defendants, they have their own inquiries, and I don't think that should be the basis for reversal. They have their own issues about their own defendants, and that's just the nature of joint trials. Is it so prejudicial to Mr. Stewart to grant him a new trial? And I say no. He was able to get 12 jurors who said that they could be fair to both defendants. They answered all the questions the best of their ability. They went through jury voir dire, and there were 12 fair people who listened to the evidence and came to a result.
Justice Sada, do you have any further questions for Mr. Roger? How about you, Justice Gibbons? Thank you, Mr. Roger.
Thank you.
Mr. Bryson, you have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. First of all, I'm not asking this court to expand Chartier. I'm asking this court to follow what it said in Chartier as far as antagonistic defenses. So what this court said is this court has held that severance may be required where a failure to sever hinders a defendant's ability to prove his theory of the case. That's Chartier. What difference in theories can there be from these tapes when O.J. wants the tape in so that he can prove his right to recover this property, and us saying, using our timeline, saying, we're not here when this conspiracy was hatched. There was no testimony that Mr. Stewart talked to anyone about planning this. When Mr. Riccio took the stand, I questioned him, and he repeatedly said, no. As a matter of fact, I never even met the man. I can't tell you if this is Mr. Stewart on this recording. He never spoke to me about planning. I asked him, how about guns? All the witnesses. Mr. Stewart ever talked to you about planning, about guns, about riding over in the truck, about this is what we're going to do today? No, 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 no. Nobody placed him on this recording at the pool except for this detective that had been proven to be wrong on multiple occasions. Now, quickly, moving through a couple of other issues that we've talked about. The case we're really talking about as far as judicial misconduct is the O'Aid case, Justice Saida. And what we need to show there is overt favoritism to the state. I submit that that's demonstrated when you watch the excerpts of this.
Mr. Bryce, let me talk about it. I was on that case as a district judge sitting on the Supreme Court. In that case, the judge Lane and Marino sanctioned attorneys right in front of the jury and all like that, issued monetary sanctions, and the jury was not sent out. And I think that was one of the major bases for that. But go ahead with your argument.
And I can appreciate that. I don't think a juror actually recognizes the difference between a monetary sanction saying you're going to be sanctioned $500 for your conduct, then sit down in a manner that's like, sit down, little boy, we're tired of hearing you right now. To me, it's the same thing.
Okay.
And that's what was happening, and that's the demeanor that she had toward the defense. And there was actual prejudice that was suffered. I gave you some examples of the actual prejudice that was suffered by my client as a result of being tried next to Mr. Simpson. There were some other ones. When Tom Scotto was called to the stand, he would have never been called to the stand and asked about tampering, witness tampering, in Mr. Stewart's case. He was one of our main witnesses. And now the jury is sitting there wondering, oh my goodness, are they reaching out and engaging either Mr. Scotto or his wife? That's another example of antagonistic defense where I made a motion to sever. Mr. Galanter wanted to go in and say, well, Detective Caldwell meant Scotto's wife. I was of the opinion that I don't want to go into this at all because it simply highlights it. Whether it's Scotto's wife or Scotto himself, the jury gets the idea that this is a bad act that's happening.
Okay, Mr. Bryson, let me ask you this. Mr. Rogers said that you objected to the audio tape. Mr. Glanter wanted it in. His argument is that if you have co-defendants, they could kind of game the system and have somebody want it in, somebody not want it in, to try and create issues for appeal and all like that. So therefore, we shouldn't recognize that. What's your comments on that?
Well, my comment is I think we all recognize that there are certain pieces of evidence that may be admissible against one defendant that are not admissible against another defendant. And when those kind of pieces of evidence are coming in, the judge should undertake an analysis. And certainly, I believe, as an affirmative duty outside the presence of the jury to find out exactly what the impact is going to be here. Judge Glass didn't do that over my objection for severance time and time again as it pertained to these recordings. There is no possible, conceivable explanation for playing a recording that deals with a California murder or California civil case and playing comments from a detective that's investigating this case saying, California couldn't effing get it, we're going to get it. What possible significance, other than to infuse OJ's bias and prejudice against my client, could there be for playing that piece of recording? That one piece, in and of itself, I submit to this court, is so prejudicial that it warranted severance in and of it by itself.
Thank you, Mr. Bryson. Thank you, Mr. Rogers. Thank both lawyers for their professionalism in this matter and their fine arguments and briefs also. Ms. Cummings, this matter will stand submitted also, and we'll be in recess for a few minutes to our next call of the